Despite pessimistic views, the world is richer, healthier, and kinder than ever before. If that's the case, then why do people often have pessimistic views of the present and the future, despite increasing progress year by year? And what's some empirical evidence you have that contradicts this negative view?
Yeah, well, I'm like everyone. I get worried and anxious and gloomy about the future and things. But some years ago, I set out to write a book pointing out that things aren't all bad. And the more I looked into it, I thought, actually, very few things are bad compared with the past. Yes, the world is a vale of tears compared with what it could be. But compared with what it was, it is spectacular how much we have changed human living standards. And as you say, made us wealthier, healthier, happier, cleverer, kinder, freer, more peaceful, and more equal. You know, just to give you the sort of most striking statistics, when I was born, around half the world lived in extreme poverty, defined by around $2 a day national income per person, corrected for inflation. Today, that number is something like 8%. That's an incredible lifting out of poverty that's gone on all around the world. And it's happened to more to poor people than to rich people. And it's been accompanied by the most spectacular technologies that enable us to survive diseases and communicate seamlessly over the airwaves and so on. And then, you know, bad things like child mortality, you know, again, in my lifetime, it's gone from something like, it's down by something like 2/3, you know, and child mortality is the single biggest measure of misery I can think of. Nothing worse than having to bury a child. Fewer and fewer people have to do that in every country. Well, there's one or two exceptions where things are going in the wrong direction, but very few. So on the whole, we're seeing this incredible improvement in our lives, and it doesn't feel like that, does it? You know, very few people wake up in the morning and say, gosh, aren't I lucky? You know, it's great. And that's partly because we take the improvements for granted. It's partly because we quite rightly worry more about the things going wrong than celebrate the things going right. It's partly because good news is gradual and bad news is sudden. I think that's a really important factor, actually, because, you know, flying an airliner into a building on purpose is news. Lifting hundreds of people out of poverty in a single day somehow isn't news, because it happens every day and you can't pin down where it's happening and so on. So so those are some of the reasons why I think you have to fight to remind people that the world has been getting better and can probably go on getting better. But of course, there are limits to how optimistic you can be. And of course, it's not the same as saying everything's fine. You know, quite the reverse. The reason I'm passionate about drawing people's attention to this is to say, look, the world is still a terrible place for lots of people, but we've improved it for lots of people so we can do it again. So please don't be Panglossian and say it can never get better, because that's the worst crime of all, to say, oh, well, no point in even trying, you know. So I think that's where my motivation comes from anyway. I've had a lot of fun being a lonely rational optimist the last 10, 15 years since I wrote that book. There are parts of me that are slightly less optimistic now than they were for various reasons. I'm sure we can come on to talk about that.
Yeah.
But on the whole, I still think we're not recognizing the incredible improvements that are possible.
And is this correct? Am I correct in saying that in the 1960s and probably the 1970s as well, there were actually slums still in places like Glasgow and Edinburgh and large cities in the UK? And there were these, I can't remember the name of the housing design, but they were these really tightly terraced houses, which were basically back to back with each other, which no longer exists apart from in maybe one town in northern UK. But that just shows the progress that we've made. And am I also correct in saying that we're, as a lower middle class or a working class person in a developed Western country today, actually you have more luxuries than maybe Louis XIV had, or better living quality than a French king. Is that correct?
Yes. You weren't around in the 60s and 70s. We thought we were okay, but you know, we had access to, very few people had cars. Quite a lot of people didn't have central heating. Most people wouldn't have had washing machines or dishwashers. Some people didn't even have fridges.
Wow.
Some people didn't even have electric light or indoor toilets or something, you know, in Britain, you know, let alone in other countries, you know, one of the richest countries in the world. So, we weren't all miserable, and, you know, and I was very lucky. I was upper middle class and able to have a good lifestyle. But if I took you back to the average living standards of the 1960s and 70s, it's not just the lack of Wi-Fi that you'd be complaining about. The cost of food and the cost of light and the cost of, you know, heating and those kind of things were way higher. So there's that. The Louis XIV thing was a bit of fun that I had. Louis XIV was probably the richest, certainly the most prominent person on the planet at the time in terms of opulence. And he had 498 people to prepare his dinner every night. Chefs and sous chefs working for him. And, you know, it's their job is to feed him. You have 498 people working for you to prepare your dinner tonight. I don't know where you live, but I'm willing to bet that within an hour's drive of where you live, there are plenty of restaurants with at least 498 food prep people working who can supply you with a really good dinner. In many cases, better than anything Louis XIV had, because he didn't have mangoes. He didn't have, you know, fresh fish or whatever. If he did, it wasn't that fresh, and so on. So that's just one little example. And by the way, he didn't have a decent dentist. He didn't have a decent doctor. You know, there are lots of other ways in which his life wasn't as good as yours. The difference, of course, is that they were working only for him.
Yes.
And the 498 people preparing your dinner are working for whoever turns up in their restaurant and is prepared at an hour's notice or less to order a decent meal. And for me, that's quite an important point, because we're working for each other. That's the human trick, is to work for each other. I'll do what I'm good at, you do what you're good at, and we'll exchange and swap, and we're both better off for the exchange. And if we do that on a massive scale, we're all raising each other's living standards. And in the sort of pre-industrial age that Louis XIV lived in, the only way you could have a decent standard of living was having a whole ton of people working for you who then had extremely low standards of living themselves. Mm. Now, we can all have quite a good standard of living working for each other. And that, for me, is the essence of the human achievement.
Mm. And is the problem of comparison being quite relative also a factor in this negativity? Because we might have amazing living conditions compared to a Victorian peasant who, if their tooth was rotten, they would potentially maybe die from the infection. But because we have such good living standards across the board, and social media exists so we can virtue and status signal, and it can be spread out to the entire world, does that make us seem actually worse off than we would imagine a Victorian peasant to be back in the day?
Yeah, I think the human instinct is always to look at relative prosperity, not absolute. And so in a way, I'm banging my head against a brick wall by trying to get people to look at the absolute numbers. The relative matters because, you know, back in the Stone Age, you had 10 more cattle than I did, and therefore you got the girl and I didn't, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
You know, so there is a zero-sum aspect to certain aspects of human competition, that where relative is what counts. And I think that's absolutely right, that the possibility of comparing yourself to Elon Musk is so available to us now, that we're constantly aware of what we've not got and other people have got. Whereas, you know, if you're in a rural village in medieval England and everyone else looks much the same as you and has much the same standard of living, except maybe, you know, the priest or the chief at the end of the street, then you don't have quite as much to stir up your awareness of how much you could be better off. So yeah, it's an uphill battle getting people to notice that their standards of living have improved when they haven't always improved relatively.
Mm. And what role does nostalgia play in this? Because we always see the early days as this through rose-tinted glasses, right? And we imagine that we're Julius Caesar and not this peasant who's worked on the same plot of land for the entire life. Why do we have this? Is it right in saying it's irrational? Like this irrational belief that the good old days were actually the good old days and not the less developed days, I guess?
I think that's exactly the problem. When we teach history about kings and, you know, or the upper middle class. We don't hear about the vast majority of people who weren't living. So just to give my favorite example, if you watch a Jane Austen movie, they're all dancing under a lot of candles in Meryton Town Hall or whatever it is, in Pride and Prejudice. Do you know how much a candle cost? And I do know, actually, in 1800, on the average US wage, but it would have been much the same in the UK, you would have had to work for 6 hours to buy a tallow candle that would give you a reasonable amount of light to read a book by for an hour. 6 hours of work for 1 hour of light. Today, you have to work for about a fifth of a second to earn that much light, okay, wow, on the average current wage. So that's just, it's the labor cost of supplying those needs that has changed so dramatically. Sorry, I've got diverted from nostalgia, which was what you asked about. And yeah, I think we remember the good, even within our own lifetimes. I'm in my 60s, we constantly telling each other how much nicer it was in the 1970s or 60s, because we remember the good things. We don't remember the bad things. Mm-hmm. But going back to previous ages, as you say, we assume we were Napoleon and not the soldier in his army who had nothing to eat and no shoes on his feet and blah, blah, blah. And there's a rather wonderful fact that Hesiod, who is a very, very early Greek poet living in the golden age of what was regarded in later Athens as the golden age, Hesiod complains that things aren't as good as they used even then.
And I'm not sure how much knowledge you know about the dark or middle ages, but is that another fad? Was it actually as bad as people say it was compared to previous eras?
Well, Here's an interesting one. I do think there are periods in human history when people got it right and things went well. You know, the Song Dynasty in China around 1000 AD. Ancient Greece, not great for slaves and things like that, but, you know, there was something pretty special going on in terms of human enlightenment, human living standards, trade, et cetera, et cetera. And these periods were followed by a descent into much worse times of war and local subsistence and so on. And even in our own more recent times, you know, there is no doubt that the Great Depression, particularly in America, was a time of retreat into extreme poverty for quite a lot of people. So, you know, things can go backwards. There is no doubt about that. And, you know, in that sense, there's a tendency nowadays to say the Dark Ages weren't as dark as you thought. And it's true that actually there was somewhat there's quite a lot of innovation in the Dark Ages, which kind of didn't happen in the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire wasn't very good at innovating, actually. Civil engineering, yes, but not on many other things. Okay, I'm going to get into what did the Romans do for us if I'm not careful here. But, but you know, things like inventing hay or inventing stirrups or whatever it might be, you know, there's quite a lot of that stuff that happens in the Dark Ages. But all the same, I think, you know, if you lived in Rome in the first century AD and at the time of Cicero and you could have quite a good life. And if you lived in Rome 500 years later, in the 600s or the 500s, the population of the city had shrunk by something like 80%.
Wow.
And the, you know, there's absolutely no chance of getting imported goods from India and Egypt like there would have been in the earlier period, etc. So things can go backwards. And that's one of the things I'm wrestling with in the next book I want to write is, you know, is it possible that I'm like the guy who's falling out of the skyscraper and he's shouting so far so good as he passes the second story? Is that just around the corner, is there a crash coming like happened to the Song Dynasty in China, where they had this fantastic innovation period and food was pretty cheap and there was a lot of art and a lot of culture. And then they basically, there's a Mongol invasion and it all goes to pot, and then the Ming emperors get in charge and they basically become autocratic and centralized, and China descends into really extreme poverty. So, you know, maybe I'm celebrating too soon.
Mm-hmm. Do you think has the rate of innovation continually compounded, like it's got faster and faster? Is that correct? Am I correct in saying that recently?
I don't think so, actually. I think, you know, we tend to say that, and certainly compared with 500 years ago, yes, there's been a massive acceleration in innovation, and we now expect innovative products to come rattling along. But I'm also very struck by how some technologies innovate at a much greater pace than others, and then slow down and other ones take over. So my favorite example of this is my grandparents were born around the turn of the 20th century and died in the sort of 1970s or whatever. They lived through incredible changes in transport.
Mm.
They saw the first airplanes, the first cars, the first helicopters, the first rockets, the first space travel, all happened in their lifetime. You know, they went from, yes, there were trains when they were born, but there wasn't much else. Whereas they saw very little change in communication and computing. There was the telephone before they were born, and there was the telephone when they died.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a lot else happens in their lifetime. There's early stirrings of computing, but it's not much in the 1950s in terms of the impact on actual life. I've had exactly the opposite experience. I was born in the 1950s. Since when? Name me a significant transport innovation. Budget airlines, drones. Yeah, there's a few. But it's not, you know, cup holders in cars. You know, it's not as impressive. It's certainly in terms of speed. You know, I mean, if anything, air travel's got slower.
Yeah.
Car travel's got slower. Congestion is more of a problem. It's got cheaper. It's got safer. Air travel is way safer than it was, you know, in the 1950s. So, yeah, it's not nothing. But it's pretty pathetic compared with what my grandparents lived through. Whereas in computing and communication, I've seen computers suddenly everywhere, mobile telephones everywhere, the internet, social media, artificial intelligence. I've seen this incredible digital revolution. So I would say that the illusion we have today of constantly accelerating innovation is only true when we focus on digital electronics, actually. If you turn your attention to any other technology, you can make the case, you know, we haven't built a new design of nuclear power station for 50 years now, I think, or something like that. You know, so there are certain technologies that accelerate at certain times, and I don't feel that there's an overall pace of acceleration of innovation.
What do you think is going to be the next field or industry to increase the most after computing?
Well, this is interesting, because if you'd asked people in 1960, where are all the innovations going to come from, they would mostly reply with transport.
Wow.
Actually, they would talk about routine space travel, personal gyrocopters, you know, all this kind of stuff. I've got a lovely cartoon, actually, from the year I was born of the future in the year 2000. And it shows a mailman delivering physical letters with a rocket strapped to his back. Now, they've got that wrong both ways. Mailmen are not using rockets, but we're not sending physical letters either. We're sending electronic messages. So they've underestimated the impact of electronic improvement, but they've overestimated the impact of transport. And therefore, sitting today saying, oh, the future is all about AI, we may be wrong, actually.
Yeah.
You know, and in some sense, you can see a slowing down of Moore's law and electronic communications and mobile phones. You know, the signal hasn't got much better in the last 10 years. I don't feel the need to replace my smartphone every few years the way I did 10 years ago, et cetera. So in that sense, we may be looking at the wrong technology when we obsess about AI and internet and social media and things. And if that's true, and I can't guarantee that it is, then maybe it's biomedicine we should be thinking about.
That's what I was thinking.
Because I think the CRISPR gene editing technologies, the new vaccine manufacturing things, the ability to read genomes, these are having an incredible effect on technologies. And we haven't seen much impact from that yet in our everyday lives. Yes, there are new medicines and so on. But I think we might be about to live through a golden age of biomedical innovation, which would be wonderful.
Yeah, I've had a few people come on to do with the longevity movement, and they're on the frontier of it with the nanotechnology, with the senescent cells, and talking about injecting stuff into your body that can reverse aging. It all seems so sci-fi, but I guess it could be the next one.
Wait, hold that thought. I'm genuinely so grateful that you've stuck around with us to listen to these fascinating insights from the guest so far. If this episode has given you one piece of knowledge which has helped you understand yourself and the world a little bit better than before, the absolute best way to support us is to pay it forward and hit the share button right now. Don't let this knowledge stay hidden. Please send it to one person who will benefit from this episode. Thank you so much. Let's dive back into the rest of the episode.
Or to put it bluntly, and a former UK health minister said this to me, I think Ozempic is a bigger revolution than AI. Discuss.
Yeah.
Skinny young people don't worry about these things.
Anyway. Maybe in a few decades. How long has it been around for, though? I swear it's been around for a few decades, Ozempic, but was it to do with diabetics?
Yeah, exactly. It's a really fascinating story. You know, the search starting in anglerfish and then going on to Gila monsters, these lizards that only eat three times a year. The search for glucagon-like peptide is the technical term for the chemicals in question. But of course, it's only about 7 or 8 years ago that they suddenly realized that this is not just about treating diabetes. This could be about treating obesity as well. And then there's a whole string of accelerated improvements. So we're still living through it. I mean, I'm sure it's going to be in pill form in a couple of years. But, you know, the number of people I know who've changed shape in the last few years. And it's not just bodily shape. They change appetite. They, you know, this seems to really help with addiction of various kinds. You know, so it's not going to be a wonder drug. And, you know, the word Ozempic is wrong because that's actually the diabetic version. I think Wegovy and all these other names are out there, but they're all part of the same general technologies. It's not going to be one wonder drug, but I think, you know, there are people saying it has an effect on inflammation. It might have an effect on cancer. You know, there are going to be, there's a bit of a gold rush coming from that technology in particular and similar drug discovery in general.
Mm. And just going back a bit, why has the rational optimist become a bit less optimistic? Why has that changed?
Well, the sort of cultural background of the world is so negative at the moment. I'm talking about things like the culture wars. I'm talking about immigration debates. I'm talking about politics. I'm talking about the rise of autocracy in China and Russia and places like that. That I need to consider the possibility that this civilization is going to shut down the innovation engine. Not completely. And my real pessimism isn't that we're going to see no innovation and growth, economic growth in the next 50 years, but that we're going to see a much slower rate than we could. And at my most glib, I put this in a sort of Sun headline as the growth of bureaucracy and superstition. We are so good at getting bureaucratic delay and obfuscation in the way of new technologies, nuclear power, infrastructure developments, what I said about airplanes not improving, that's partly a political problem. You know, we've just regulated that industry to death and created an industry that doesn't dare do any meaningful innovation. And there's a graph that I'm fascinated by, which is five scenarios of what might happen to global GDP per capita in the rest of this century. And these are the five scenarios that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change considers when it is considering how much emissions there are going to be. And they're cartoonish things, you know, they're quite simplistic, but nonetheless, and they've deliberately given five very different scenarios. They range from a doubling of GDP per capita to a 14-fold increase during the current century from the year 2000 to the year 2100. Now, just imagine what a 14-fold increase, or 10-fold from here, would do. You know, imagine having 10 times as much disposable income, not just you, but everybody on the planet. Think what you could do with that. Think how you could renew all your infrastructure, how you could cure lots of environmental problems, desalinate water for people to drink, green the deserts. You know, there's just a tenfold increase in income is truly amazing when you think about it. If we have policies that make sure we only get a threefold instead of a tenfold, the opportunity cost of that to mankind is massive. And I'm quite cross about that. So in a sense, my pessimism is part of my optimism. You know, my optimism about what we could achieve compared with my pessimism about what we will achieve is where I get cross.
And is bureaucracy a natural part of evolution in a way? Or because, you know, a company that's a startup will be a team of 10 and they'll be, you know, making rapid iterations, and then they'll go through stages, and then they might end up like IBM, where it's just so many employees and it's gone to a standstill. Why does this keep repeating in human endeavors?
Yep. It's a natural incrustation of human institutions that they grow. It is natural for people because of empire building, you want to maximize your budget, and you want to maximize the number of staff you employ and that kind of thing. So and governments are particularly bad at this, but big companies, as you say, are pretty bad at it too. And I once asked Jeff Bezos how he was going to keep Amazon innovative, even as it grew to be a gigantic company. And he had some quite nice answers, actually. Things like the two pizza rule, that, no meeting should ever be so big that you need more than two pizzas mm-hmm. to feed it. But there was one particular thing he said, which I really liked, which was he wanted reverse veto, where a layer of management couldn't veto a new idea by majority rule. He wanted the chief executive to be able to hear about an unpopular idea that a junior employee had, if you like. Mm. Now, I think since Bezos left Amazon day to day, it's probably become bad at all that. And I bet they're having huge meetings and, not letting good ideas come up from the bottom and all this kind of thing. Mm. There is a natural tendency for bureaucracy to grow like mold on bread, right? But the great thing about the private sector is that if you allow that to happen, like Kodak or Nokia or IBM, and you stop innovating, then you die. IBM didn't die. It reinvented itself, but the other two basically died. So the small upstart drive out the big sluggish ones. And, I'm willing to bet that OpenAI, the inventor of ChatGPT, will be a sort of gigantic sluggish behemoth in about 10 years' time, but it'll come crashing down and someone else will take over. What we haven't managed to do is invent a way for inefficient government departments to die. They are eternal. They are immortal. And that's a big part of our problem. And I think, working out a way for bureaucracy to reinvent itself in the public sector is a huge task. And it's one that, let's face it, previous empires failed at. This is the story of the Roman Empire. This is the story of the Arabian Empire. This is the story of the Ottoman Empire, of the Ming Empire. You get mandarins and other bureaucrats giving themselves more and more taxpayers' money until the whole enterprise doesn't make sense anymore. So that is a challenge we face.
Mm. And where's the UK in this life cycle?
I'm extremely pessimistic about the UK. I shouldn't be. I think we've got a lot going for us. The English language, the rule of law, a great financial center, fantastic position in the world, trading system, fantastic universities, great scientists, more biomedical innovations than any other country, possibly even including America. I could list you the UK's incredible strengths. But then I look at what we've done in the last 15 years in particular, since the great financial crisis, and I see a country that has vastly increased its energy costs, which is absolutely fatal. In the end, economic growth is a thermodynamic phenomenon. You make useful things out of useless ones using energy. And, this conversation is hopefully more useful than it is useless. And that's because we've got energy being supplied to make it happen. And we now have the most expensive electricity costs for both domestic and industrial consumers of any major nation. Well, that's fatal. That's disastrous. But at the same time, we've got a bureaucratic planning system that prevents us building. And, you know, we've spent 40 years not building a third runway for our main airport. I mean, what is that all about? You know, I mean, how suicidal is this? And we have a very expensive government that is getting more expensive, a very top-heavy welfare system that is basically rewarding non-work at the expense of work. It's now you can actually make more money on welfare than a pretty reasonable salary in London these days now. You can get a free car, you know, just by saying you've got anxiety. You know, there's all that kind of stuff. And, I don't want to sound like I'm unsympathetic to people who need welfare, but I think an awful lot of the people who are on welfare probably don't need it or would help without it. So I'd love to see a much more radical approach to slimming down the British government and increasing the incentives for entrepreneurs. And we're seeing, you know, we're seeing capital flight. We're seeing the chemical industry leaving. We're seeing the pharmaceutical industry leaving. We're seeing the oil and gas industry leaving. We're seeing the AI industry say, "Ooh, you were really good at this 10 years ago, but not sure I want to move there because your energy costs are so high." I think this country has basically failed to grow its economy for the best part of 15 years because of bad policies. We left the European Union and failed to take any advantages of doing so. You know, I mean, I was in favor of leaving, but only if we struck out into the world and deregulated our economy and became good at innovation and stripped away external tariffs that, like we'd had in the EU. Instead of which we just said, "Oh, we're going to go on being like Europe, but not in it." Well, probably not much point in that then. So I think we're in a mess as a country. The only comfort we've got is that the Germans and the French are in almost more of a mess. But how is that any comfort? You know, this is not a zero-sum game. We could be, in a way, the innovative engine of the world economy is a vacant position at the moment. America is still it, but it's showing signs with tariff wars and so on of being not very good at that. Not very open to the world. China has been incredibly innovative, but it's becoming more and more centralized and economically as well as politically. Europe, as I say, is basically regulating itself to death.
Yeah.
And so that leaves the job vacant for some nimble, ambitious country to come out and say, "Right, I'm going to be the place where entrepreneurs move to and do their entrepreneuring."
Who are the contenders? I remember you saying something about India a few years ago.
Yeah. Well, I do have an outside bet on India. I mean, not literally, but when I was in India earlier this year, I said, "Look, apply for the job, you guys. You've got this. You've got a great education system. You've got a relatively free market. You've got infrastructure problems and corruption problems and political problems, sure, but so is everybody. You're a huge country. You produce incredibly talented people, but they mostly go and do their talenting elsewhere." I think, India could be an incredible, it could be the next China for a while, if you like. But it doesn't seem to be quite pulling it off yet. There are things happening in India, though. It's a pretty impressive place in terms of the dynamism of its economy.
Yeah, yeah. Time will tell. And what are your favorite examples of humanity's collective brain creating new innovations rather than the single inventor, which we like to tell tales of in history?
Well, pretty well every innovation is a much more collective phenomenon than we realize. We think of the genius having his eureka moment, but it's very rarely that. A, he's collaborating, B, he's building on the work of others, and C, his own innovation is only a prototype and it still needs to be improved by others. So one of my distinctions is between innovation, which is making things affordable, reliable, and available, and invention, which is coming up with the first prototype. And that's true wherever you look. I mean, my favorite example of this goes back a long way, and it's the invention of the airplane. 1903 in America, Samuel Langley, huge grant from the American government to build the first powered plane. So clever that he doesn't need to consult anyone. So he does it in secret, launches it from the top of a houseboat in front of a crowd on the Potomac River, and it splashes straight into the water, plop. The American government's furious. He is humiliated, blah, blah, blah. About 8 weeks later, on a desolate shoreline off North Carolina, two bicycle mechanics without a degree between them succeed where Langley had failed, the Wright brothers. Mm. And nobody believes them for a long time because they're bicycle mechanics from Dayton, Ohio. But they're right. And what they had done right that Langley had done wrong is that they did not think they were the cleverest people in the room. They picked the brains of people all over the world, people in Australia, people in America, people in France, people in Germany, who were working on gliders and box kites and wind tunnels and birds and, you know, all these things. And then they did a ton of trial and error, you know, years of experiments with gliders before they even tried to put an engine on a plane. So that by the time they did invent an airplane, they'd worked out how you turn right and left in the air, which wasn't an immediately easy problem to solve. Mm. So it's the humility of knowing that you're drawing on a collective intelligence to innovate that they showed, I think.
Mm, yeah. And there's one of my favorite analogies of yours is about the pencils, about no one actually knows how to create a pencil because, you know, they can't mine for the graphite. They can't do the factory work to create it.
But it's not mine. It's a guy called Leonard Reed who wrote an essay in the year I was born, probably enough, 1958, called I, Pencil. And it's this pencil that sets out to discover how it came into existence. And it concludes that millions of people contributed to making just even the simplest pencil. Mm. Because somebody had to cut down the tree from which the wood was made. Somebody had to mine the graphite from which the lead was made, and so on. And all of these people collaborated, and yet not one of them knows how to make a pencil. Because the man who runs the pencil factory doesn't know how to make a pencil because he doesn't know how to cut down trees or mine graphite. And that's... It's so important. I want every school child in the world to read that essay because it's a very short essay. It's very accessible. And it just reminds us that we're all in this together. We're all helping each other. It's a collaborative enterprise. The fact that you don't make your own clothes is not a bad thing. It's a good thing. Mm. It means that we're all helping each other.
Yeah, and we have time to do the thing we're best at and the thing we're strongest at, which will contribute the most to humanity, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, producing podcasts on a Wednesday morning is a very important service to the rest of
people. Of course, of course. And I wanted to talk about your newest book. And
thank you.
What the key ideas, the key insights people can expect to learn from it.
Yeah. The book is called Bird, Sex and Beauty. and it's a very different book from many of my other ones, but it does actually return to the theme of my very first book about science, which was called The Red Queen. And indeed the subjects that I studied for my PhD many years ago. And it's this question of where does animal beauty come from, particularly bird beauty. Why are so many male birds decorated with fantastic colors, extravagant plumage, beautiful elegance, etc.? what's the point of this beauty? And Darwin, Charles Darwin, was very interested in this, very worried about it, actually, because he couldn't explain it at first. And it was quite a good argument of the creationists was to say, well, we've got a good answer to that. You know, God made these things beautiful to please us. So he needed an alternative explanation, and he came up with one, which is that females prefer beautiful males. That females have been, in a very few cases, it's the other way around. There are some birds in which it's the females that are brightly colored and beautiful and the males that are dull and boring. But the females are breeding males to be flamboyant in the way that pigeon breeders or bantam breeders are breeding birds to be. And nobody believed him. And everybody said that's nonsense. And in particular, his friend Alfred Russel Wallace, who is the co-discoverer of natural selection, said nonsense. No, no, no. It's just because male birds have more energy and so they might as well grow longer feathers. Well, that's not much of an explanation. And it wasn't until the mid-20th century that Ronald Fisher explained why females might prefer more beautiful males, possibly because they want to pick the healthiest male, and this is a way of telling. But there's reasons why that, to me, is not a very convincing argument in itself. But more importantly, because the females might want to have sons who are not just healthy, but attractive to the opposite sex. And that the whole thing is a sort of circular argument. Mm-hmm. That being beautiful is important because if you're not beautiful, your children won't be beautiful, and then the females won't go for you. So once the females start expressing a preference, that is going to drive the development of beautiful plumage, which is going to drive the female preference, and the two are going to snowball together. And that's why you get such extraordinary ornaments as a peacock's tail, or such extraordinary behavior as this thing called lecking, which black grouse do, which is the species I study and I write about, particularly in the book, where the males all have to gather together in one spot and display their wares to the female, and she chooses the best one. And this, you know, this is a tyrannical system that the males are forced into, as it were. And my point is that this is a very important form of evolution, seduction of the hottest rather than survival of the fittest, if you like, because it produces creative, extravagant, and eccentric results in a way that natural selection doesn't. And we are underestimating its importance on the whole. We're thinking it's just another version of natural selection. I don't think that's right. I think it's much more interesting than that. And it might even be the best explanation for why human brains got so big.
That's what
I say at the end of the book. That's not the purpose of the book. The purpose of the book is just to enjoy the arguments over bird beauty. But I do think that the evolution is an incredibly important topic for everything, because lots of things evolve. You know, technology evolves, language evolves, in a very real sense.
Yeah.
I kind of want the rest of the world not to think of evolution as just a peculiarity of biology, but a way of understanding the world that's really important.
Definitely, yeah. And how does it relate to human brain size?
Well, as I said, we need an explanation for why the human brain expanded in size very rapidly and accelerated in expansion at huge cost to the species, because a lot of women had to die because they couldn't give birth to babies with big heads for this to happen, as that's still happening to some extent. So there must have been a huge advantage to having a big brain. Now, what is that advantage on the savannah a million years ago in Africa? Well, we assume it's to help you navigate your way through the day, find food and survive bad weather and that kind of thing. And that's the sort of natural selection explanation. But, it, you know, baboons didn't need that. Gazelles didn't need that. There are plenty of other animals on the savannah who are not doing that. Maybe it's to cope with the social challenges of living in a large society. Maybe. But again, baboons didn't need that. They live in large social groups. And anyway, we kind of live in such large social groups because we have big brains and can cope with it. You know, where's cause and effect here?
Mm.
A third possibility is that actually, let's look at what we use those big brains for. We don't just use them to solve practical problems or social problems. We also use them to do art and song and linguistic sort of extravagance. We use them to seduce. 90% of pop songs are about love.
Probably more than that.
Probably more than that.
Yes.
You know, 90% of poems are about love. Quite a lot of novels are about love. Maybe we, you know, what is the point of a sense of humor? You know, why do we tell jokes? It doesn't help us survive. It doesn't help cement the social group together necessarily. Maybe it does, but that's not a very convincing argument. Why are men constantly telling jokes? Because they're hoping it'll impress women. Come on. The elephant in the room.
Yeah.
And so Geoffrey Miller has argued in a very convincing and very well-written book called The Mating Mind 25 years ago, that actually the expansion of the human brain might well have been driven by sexual selection, not natural selection. That is to say, one sex or the other, we don't really know which, maybe both, always gave mating rewards to individuals with bigger brains.
Hmm.
And that became a runaway self-reinforcing process. And our brain is therefore our equivalent of the peacock's tail.
That's really interesting. That's really interesting. But then we have all these byproducts of that as well. And are you saying,
yes,
are you saying it relates all the way back to seduction? Fundamental.
Well, if we, it endowed us with bigger brains so that we could be more poetic, but it ended up making us capable of inventing aeroplanes.
Mm-hmm.
That would be the argument.
Yeah, but do you think someone
created the other way around?
Yeah. Do you think someone tried to create the aeroplane to seduce more women, though?
Well, that's not impossible either, because great innovators have tended to get sexual rewards. You know, and there's particularly art in the case of art, you know, I mean, there really is an aphrodisiac quality to being a great artist, apparently.
Mm. Yeah.
I wouldn't know. I'm not one.
Well, Picasso is a good example of that.
Who?
Picasso.
Picasso, exactly.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. And then there's quite a few poets as well. And isn't it normally because language is seductive to women a lot of the time? That's a very powerful situation.
I think we have to be careful not to be too sexist here. I suspect it was going both ways. I suspect verbal fluency was helpful in women seducing the better men, because we are a species that tends to form pair bonds. And we're therefore like quite a lot of seabirds, in which, you know, puffins, for example, grow these brightly colored beaks in the spring. Both sexes do.
Mm-hmm.
And we know now that there is mutual sexual selection going on there, that you know, it's harder to get a mate in the world of puffins if you haven't got a brightly colored beak. And that's true for males and females. So I think we need to think of it as, it's not like a peacock's tail in that sense. It's more like a puffin's beak.
Yeah, and two prime examples would be Cleopatra, apparently her voice and language was incredibly seducing. And I think Josephine Bonaparte as well, her voice was very seductive to, obviously, Napoleon.
Well, yeah, there's many a female singer, you know, who today would illustrate that point as well.
Mm. And how does lecking potentially relate to mating behavior in humans? Are there any similarities or examples?
Short answer, no. People love saying, oh, it looks just like a nightclub when you take them to see a black grouse lek where there's 20 males frantically singing and dancing and some very nonchalant females walking around sampling the dances. And that can have echoes of a nightclub, yes, I'm sure. But we're dealing with a very different system there because, remember, they'll all mate with the same male.
Mm-hmm.
On a typical lek, one male gets 90% of the lek of the matings. The females sample a lot, but then they all agree which one is the one that they're going to mate with. Now, that is not what happens in human beings. We pair off. We're a much more monogamous species, like many other birds are. So this extraordinary behavior of lekking is not something that translates across to the human world, I think. And I think it's a mistake to see it. Yes, of course, you can make sort of cartoonish comparisons, but they don't really work.
Yeah. And in the less monogamous birds, is there more disparity in appearance between the birds? So, for example, collar doves, they're monogamous and the male and female look almost identical. But then in grouse, for example, like your example gives, where they're not as monogamous, is that what is, I guess,
correct?
The aesthetic differences are more pronounced.
Yeah. Polygamous behavior results in bright coloration or large size in the sex that gets to have lots of mates. That is a general rule across the animal kingdom. It's not universal, because there are quite a lot of birds where the male is more brightly colored than the female. A chaffinch, for example, in your garden, the male is much smarter than the female. But they form pair bonds, and the male does help bring up the offspring. So we thought, well, this is a bit weird. Why do you need to be brightly colored if you're monogamous? And the answer was discovered some years ago through genetic fingerprinting, which is that they're not nearly as monogamous as we thought.
Really?
There's a lot of surreptitious extra pair copulation going on. That, you know, the most brightly colored chaffinch has a little affair with the female who's married to the less brightly colored chaffinch.
Is that slightly more applicable to humans?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
No,
is it the same with house sparrows as well? They've got some amazing mating dynamics, don't they?
I think you're thinking of hedge sparrows or dunnocks.
Maybe. Because they have two females for one male.
Polyandry and polygyny and a lot of sperm competition, as it's called. The female is deliberately mating with more than one male, and there's a lot of competition happening inside her body as the sperm races towards the eggs.
Wow. Oh, God. We're going to have to do a part two on hedge sparrows.
Testis size in birds and in mammals turns out to be a good indicator of promiscuity. In species where females are mating with more than one male, males tend to have big testicles.
And then vice versa for the monogamous ones.
Yeah, males tend to have small testicles, yes.
Okay. All right, as a final question, if you could give your 20-year-old self one piece of advice, what would it be and why?
It's a really good question. And I would go on for hours trying to tell this idiot bloke what he was getting wrong. But I think the one I would give is the future's bright. Because when I was 20, I assumed that we were facing decline and fall as a civilization because all the grown-ups told me that. And I needed a needed to be told, actually, you know, your living standard's going to improve, and so is that of many other people, including poor people. The opportunities are incredible. The threats are there, but they're not as bad as you think.
Mm. Very good advice. I mean, that's understandable because were you growing up during the Cold War, the nuclear procedures and all of that stuff? That would be terrifying.
No, the population explosion was unstoppable. Nuclear war was inevitable. Pollution was going to shorten our lifespan. The deserts were advancing. The ice age was coming back. There was this constant drumbeat of gloom and doom in the 70s, 60s and 70s.
Mm. So what's one action you
Like there is today.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And that begs me to ask, what's one action you want viewers to take from this conversation, if anything?
Dare to be an optimist.
Mm. Perfect.
The problems we face are challenges to be solved, not existential threats that can't be avoided.
Mm.
And we're worrying about the wrong things. We should be worrying about bureaucracy and superstition. Instead, we're worrying about climate change and AI.
Mm. Very, very good advice. Matt Ridley, ladies and gentlemen. Lord Ridley, really appreciate this and love to do a part two on the Dunnocks in the future. And I'm excited. I'm curious to know what you're currently working on. You mentioned a potential new book as well.
Ah, yes. You'll have to wait and find out.
Okay. Well, when I see it, I'll send you an email to ask you more about it.
Don't hold your breath. It'll be a while.
Yeah. Of course. Yeah. Is it once Thank every 5 years normally?
I mean, I hope to have a new book out in 2027, and it deals with some of the issues we've talked about today.
Awesome. And where can people go if they want to find the latest book?
MattRidley.co.uk. They can get all my books from all good bookshops, including audio. I recorded the audio version of my last book.
Awesome. I'll leave the link to that in the show notes.
Thank you. I really enjoyed talking to you, Jacob. Good luck.
Awesome. Nice to meet you and hopefully speak to you soon. And I'll obviously let you know when the episode's out. Thank you so much, Matt.
Yes, please. Thank you.
If you've made it this far, you're likely not just a listener. You're ready to be the host. You felt that sense of intimacy and connection with our guest today, and you would like to get the same on your own show and start your own dream show. But you're worried about landing dream guests and all the complications and the mess that is often spoken about when starting your own podcast from scratch. You think starting a podcast requires a huge budget and a whole team, right? That is absolute nonsense. My Pro Remote Podcast Blueprint is the ultimate key to skipping the outdated advice and building a high quality, high impact show, even for under $100. It provides the proven strategies and AI templates that I use this day that you will be able to use to reclaim your time and creative control. And this is a strictly limited opportunity. Don't dilly-dally because there's limited spaces. We've already got one student, Rob, who's joined. That means there's only a couple more spaces to get the Promo Podcast Blueprint course half price. And you need to act very, very fast because this is a limited offer and you're very, very early. So if you want to get the early bird discount like Rob has and get the results by watching the course that goes through the exact step-by-step blueprint that I use to this day to create these episodes that you've just watched and get the success and become Europe's fastest growing under 21 podcaster and also join live weekly calls with me and use the AI templates and email templates that I use every single day to get the results and just get all my secrets without getting any of the mistakes and failures that I've made, then top link in the description is for you. And if you're ready to launch your own show and get personalized one-to-one help from me and copy my blueprint, which no other podcaster has shared, then I'll see you there. I'm rooting for you. Goodbye. Hope you enjoyed the episode too.